Hi, everyone. It's the clean call for March 15th, 2016, and welcome to everyone. Are there any announcements?
Is Johanna with us yet? I guess not. So I'll wait until... I'll just announce her, even though she may not be online or she's on mute. Johanna from Earth Day Network, who used to be the director of education there, and I'm really bad at saying her last name, so I'm not going to say it. she's a student now in the Netherlands or Holland, and she's recently agreed to be a ESIP student fellow. And one of the reasons why we wanted to do that was to provide more support for Tamara and the clean team who coordinate these calls. Given that Scott is deciding to spend more time in his retired life and his service has been most valuable and appreciated, but as we've said in previous calls, we want to, you know, begin succession planning. And you're doing exactly one of the things that Johanna is going to be doing in the future with others as well. So maybe in that interim, Johanna's joined us. Not. We'll introduce. You there?
Yeah, I am. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, now I can.
Oh, great.
So thank you, Johanna.
No problem. Thanks so much, and great to talk with all of you guys.
So, Johanna, just want to say a couple things about who you are and where you're coming from?
Sure, yeah. So for the past couple of years, I was working at Earth Day Network, working on education issues, so I was on the clean call a bit back then, and have worked a lot on climate education with quite a few people, probably maybe even on the call. And now I have started to continue my education. I am over in the Netherlands studying at the University of Utrecht. And I am studying sustainable business and innovation over here. So I'm really excited to continue working on climate education and maybe also bring new perspectives from my studies over here.
Thank you, Alan.
That's wonderful. In fact, Hannah, that would be interesting if we can bring some folks in from the EU to join us on these calls and other things that we do here in the States. So great.
Yeah, I would love that. I'll definitely keep that in mind and see who I can connect with over here and start to facilitate that.
That's very good. Well, we'll be talking later. This is Scott Carley first.
Hi, Scott.
Great.
Hi there, Scott. And I bet that's Kristen. This is...
Yeah. Do you have an announcement?
Can you hear me, Scott?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. I had the very great pleasure of participating in the Climate Science in the Classroom half-day webinar that Frank was on and other wonderful people this past Saturday. And over 100 people attended. The questions were great. The participation was great. The presentations were great. And it was a wonderful mix of bringing teachers up to speed on the science, but also resources that they can use in the classroom. And I just think it was great. So thank you, Frank, if you're on.
I am, Jane. I appreciate that. I just so you guys have a little bit more context, one of the things we were exploring is how to do new models of teacher professional development, given the new standards and the reliance on climate content with our partner NSCA. The one downside in this model is that there's a fee, between $60 and $70, depending on whether you're a member or not. But, you know, there was no money from a grant or a contract from a federal agency, which is the normal way it happens. So it's a new model, given there's less money in the community. I think, you know, one question we have is whether or not cost was a barrier. Because, you know, that program could have served 1,000 teachers just as well as it served 100.
Right.
Everything was scalable. And so, you know, it's an open question. We're actually meeting with the NSDA leadership at 2 o'clock today to begin talking about some of the next steps. But anyway, thank you for that.
Right. And I would say another piece of that, and I'm sure that's going to come up in your conversation with NSPA, was that everything you guys did was connected to the standard. And I think what we to address the money issue, it's possible that school systems will step up to the plate to cover some of the professional development costs for their teachers. But what I would like to say is, you know, $50 to $60, $70 for the amount of professional development that was offered in that very intense time period is quite reasonable. It's the price of a textbook. In fact, it's less than the price of a textbook.
So anyway, it's an ongoing conversation. We're looking at new models.
Yep. Okay. Great.
Thank you.
Don, are you on?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, so I read your email. And would you like to say... Yeah, I'm here to give you some therapy.
You're up, Don.
Actually, I'm here to share with you. I'm so glad you wrote what you did, because... last week I went to the MEES conference, and Nokia had a really big role in that. They're supporting a lot of these New England conferences that are going on this month in the different New England states. And the one in Massachusetts last week focused on the language that we use in climate change. And, of course, Nokia had their offering with the cultural bias piece that you talk about,
mm-hmm.
and how
yep.
you start up a conversation. I'm also going to the one actually tomorrow in Rhode Island, and it's going to focus, and we started talking about this on one of our teleconferences. It's looking at the classroom as a social learning community. Looking at the school as a social learning community. So the Rhode Island one will actually focus on the school and how you address different community members and their participation with the school. And so they sent out two articles for us to read in advance, and one of them is the Stanford Social Innovation Review, Climate Science's Culture War, that came out in 2012. And it does talk about that cultural bias piece. But mm-hmm. what it reminded me was of the leaders of different segments of society who people listen to. Not everybody's listening to the scientists. And Frank has brought up, and other people have brought up multiple times, it's not just about the science.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm thinking about doing is producing a very simple poster type thing on the big picture of climate change, and just having a quote from all of these different people, from all of these different segments. So that when you get together in a mixed group, you can kind of see who are your people listening to, you know, and how responsive are they to these comments about climate change from people in different venues. Because here's the big, big deal. Frank brought up, are we all thinking big enough? And I think we have mm-hmm. to address how we're thinking, which is, what are the questions about climate change that different people focus on? So it's not just who is their social group that they do a shortcut so they don't have to learn all the climate change stuff, but it's what questions do they actually zone in as being important about climate change? Is it about, is climate change really happening? So that's the science ball game. Or is it, how is, who are the winners and losers in climate change? And should we tax it or should we not tax it? So you get into economics and politics. Or what's the ethics of a developed society producing all the CO2 that caused it? And what do we owe people who live on islands who are busy getting flooded? And that's really an ethical, religious perspective. So I think we got to think big on this one.
Yeah, no doubt.
So I guess that's philosophy, and I guess that's where you were going to, Don.
Yeah, that's at least part of where I was going to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a big learning progression, isn't it?
Life is.
I suppose so. Yeah, like it's indeed.
Are our brains big enough to,
well,
it's, to
well,
handle
let me,
this?
This is Karen. Let me throw in even bigger.
Okay.
Reach. Yesterday I was at a colloquium where a man from CU who does research on learning networks, not learning communities, but learning networks, talked about his research. And I'm just going to describe to you one example that he gave in his talk of one of these networks that he's studying. And as I describe it, what I want to do is ask you as a little thought experiment, each to jot down what kind of parallels there might be in climate change education. He was describing, he deals with only wicked problems like climate change, like changing how we deal with the public forests, the forests in our country, in terms of forest management. And that's the example I'm going to give you. Because we all know that Smokey the Bear policies have not worked, and now we have fuel loads in our forests that are just huge. So there's a whole network that's working on the forest management fire suppression kind of problems. And he described the networks of everything from local, regional level groups that work on a given national forest, for instance, or in the southeast, a forest area. And those are groups that include everything from environmental groups to recreational users of forests to professional forest managers to the firefighting collection of people, and who work at a local level to decide what's needed for that particular forest, that specific local area. And then as you go up the chain, there's the regional people that deal with a whole collection of those groups at the regional level. And then you go from there up to the National Forest Service level and the issues around how to allocate budget and the legislation that needs to be passed, appropriations that need to be passed in Congress to support a different type of management and the funds to engage in that kind of management of the forests. And I just want to leave you with that kind of really broad brush, minimalist description of the networks and the layers of networks from the local to the regional to the national levels, and everything from the how do you do it on the ground to the funding of it that comes in many cases down from the top decisions in Congress. And as I was thinking of that, reading Don's email, I said to myself, you know, what we have in the Clean Network is sort of a crossbreed of the local and regional for educators, but we don't have any of the other layers that influence what we do and how we do it. And I'm wondering if thinking along those lines might get us anywhere.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah, you cut out, whoever just spoke cut out. I didn't catch that.
One thing I can share, Karen, can you guys hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm getting some cut out too, and I don't know what's leading to it, but.
Yeah, I was getting that, and I don't know if it's my phone or what. But I would like to share with you that I think there's the climate change tool that NOAA has. Am I right about that? And
which
what
one?
I want to share.
The toolkit?
I think NOAA.
Are you talking about the Climate Resilience Toolkit?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's
that
one.
About a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. And one thing I just learned about is there's a developing Massachusetts Climate Action Tool, and I'm looking to have that presented to say what.
You're cutting out too much, Jane, for me to even understand what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, ditto that.
Okay, someone else take over.
Yeah, maybe you should hang up and call in again and see if it works better the second time.
Okay, all right. Thanks.
Thanks, Jane.
Don, I don't know if you want to respond yet, given you were the starter of all this, but I had something I wanted to build into this.
Now, go right ahead, Frank.
There's another aspect to this that I think consider. Wow, our connection today is pretty bad.
Yeah,
it's pretty horrible.
Pretty bad, unusual. All the more reason for switching over to different technology.
Yeah, well, we are going to talk about switching over to another technology in the near term, just to see if it fits better than what we've got now. That's for sure. But you know, I think the point I was trying to get to, Don, in my very quick reply to you was that, you know, it took us a long time to build the social structures that we have right now. You know, and education is just one piece of that social structure. And kind of where I was going was is that the amount of time it takes to really change practice and build skill and really think critically about things. This is why I love formal education, and I don't mean that in exclusion of informal, but you have time to really explore things. And I totally support multiple modes of learning across time, as opposed to one as opposed to the other. But, you know, I don't think we have a very firm understanding in, you know, is what are all the pieces of priority learning process that you were kind of getting at that I think all of them are important together as opposed to one versus the other. And I think that's kind of where I'm going is that's it's the merger of them with intention in a new system that replaces the old system. And so, you know, if you think of Bucky Fuller's, you know, you generate a new system that just naturally replaces the old system as opposed to tearing down the current
system. Right. Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think part of what I'm wrestling with, and maybe it's just a crazy thing to wrestle with, is wondering if there's something analogous to a keystone species of ideas that, you know, if you can wrap your head around this set of ideas, what other ideas now become more comprehensible as a result of that?
Right.
Idea. I'll throw one in that comes from the deep ecology field.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember all the names of deep ecology. Joanna Macy and John Wood. I'm thinking like a mountain. It's coming up like that. But one of the things that I think that we struggle as a species is we don't think like a planet. We don't think mm-hmm. like there is a planet that is a circular economy, because you live on a circle with finite resources. And so we start thinking like a circle instead of thinking like a line. A lot of these other things are just secondary aspects. And it takes a while to think like a planet or think like a species on a planet. That's just one candidate for.
Frank, this is Scott. If I can reframe that, I hope that you appreciate it. I think that the shift that's happening is that we as a species are evolved in a way in which we respond to direct or linear causation, and the kinds of wicked problems, as Karen described them, are really systemic. And so we as a species don't know how to handle systemic causation. Things that are quite complex and have sort of planetary processes that are at play here. And that's one of the hardest things, and I think this is also in education, is that so much of what we teach is more related to the direct causation. I mean, when we teach science, we start and almost don't go very much beyond sort of classical mechanics, which is, something pushes something and there's a response to it. Basically Newton stuff, and we don't educate beyond that kind of notion. We don't really have those kinds of ideas. That maybe is the bigger idea, is to start to recognize that so many of the problems that we deal with are systemic in nature and not susceptible to an analysis that it has linear causation as its central focus. Is that a friendly amendment?
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Scott sent a note just to Frank and I that had some more detail on that, which I only had a chance to glance at before the call. But it's a helpful way of thinking about it, I think.
Well, these are sort of different names for, I think, the bigger picture thing. I like the notion of a keystone idea. I think that's a really interesting notion that, if you kind of get that one, if you understand that, everything else follows from it, which is, of course, the idea of a keystone species in ecology, that they play such an enormous role in a ecosystem. And this is an ecosystem of ideas. And so it may well be that spending time on that is also that has consequences and for the rest of the teaching that go way beyond just simply a single unit, if you see what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also think, and I also hinted this with a response to Don earlier and to Frank, is I think there's an enormous role here also for neuroscience and understanding how human brains work and hence how we process information, sensory data, and how we make decisions. And that, again, goes back to something that Don said in his thing about wondering whether we really should just be studying psychology to actually have any effect in terms of climate change. So that's I would promote that as another set of big ideas or keystone ideas.
Bye-bye. There's another word you got at on in your possible new one is the idea of evidence.
Uh-huh.
How do you determine quality of information that is informing your decisions and your actions, as opposed to somebody is purporting something to be evidence or credible, but it is far from the case. I think that's a second order function in the keystone structure in my mind, but I'm not putting it down. I think it's less important. I just think that it is supporting something else.
Yeah.
But I fully support it.
Okay.
let me ask you guys a different question here. We're kind of rolling out of steam on this. Where do we go with this? Sometimes I find these calls to be utterly interesting, but yet, you know, where do we go? What's the next step? What's the logical fruit of that process into doing something that actually changes a field of thought? And I'll say, you know, I've thought about, you know, whether or not the climate and energy literacy frameworks, we know that they've had impact, but we have no idea at what extent. But that's a policy book that did a lot of good things. But, you know, if we don't actually put things down in a certain way, they kind of just stay ideas between those on the call and those who listen to the call. How do you take an idea, polish it up, and present it in a way that is you know, changes the field?
Good question.
Well, each of us has those tools, and we construct based on our audience. How's that?
I think we need to
think of some bigger structures, and I'm not ready to say that we can get the attention of anybody in Congress. But one approach might be to work through all of our professional organizations. If we could get all the professional organizations that deal with this signed on to something, we might be able to get some attention to it.
Well, but there's another piece to it, which is that STEM, for example, not a concept I really like, but it's a concept I'm stuck with.
Yes, I'm right there with you.
I think it does more damage than good, but we're stuck with it, right? And so somebody propagated this idea that a whole lot of really influential people with a lot of money should focus on, and people who have other money who maybe can choose a different priority should focus on this one. And lo and behold, here we are. So somehow we have to do something that is STEM-like, not STEAM, STEM. Not STEM.
I'm reminded of an article I will send along directly. I'm drawing a blank on the author's name, but I'll find it and send it in just a moment here. That has to do with, well, I'll say what it's about, and then I'll find it. It came to my attention from Joe Ito, is that the right name, at the MIT Media Lab, and anti-disciplinarity. The article is from Science a couple years ago, and it's a study of studies that were influential, and it is Atypical Combinations and Scientific Impact by Brian Uzi, and it looks at what studies get the most citations as a proxy for influence, and how they approach the science, and science, the studies that are largely novel do not get cited all that much. Studies that are largely traditional do not get cited all that much. But studies that bring together well-understood concepts from different fields do get cited. And so there are a number of examples. Let me see if I can find one quickly here. I'll just go ahead and send the link right now. There it is. So it gives examples that are somewhat conjectural in terms of stuff in the real world of E-books retain page flipping graphics to remind the reader of physical books, so there's a very traditional piece to it and a very novel piece, and put together well. And so I think that's part of what Frank is talking about, that we need to think about something that is STEM-like, that gives it that attraction, but also brings in novelty to make it actually do something.
Yeah.
It's got piece of cake. It's got to be sticky. It's got to be both sticky and, yeah, it's got to be sticky. And to be sticky, it's got to be understandable. And to have impact, it's got to do something novel.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. You know, one of the things I've always thought about with the Climate Literacy Guide, you know, and the Ocean Literacy Guide, which is, you know, its precursor, was, you know, it had a name that people thought they knew what it meant. You know, and sometimes people draw their own conclusions independent of if they've actually read the thing.
Yeah.
You know, and but still, there was you could approach it. And get something out of it that was new and important for you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something there that we have to explore. Does this mean we're talking about writing a paper?
Yeah, it might.
It probably does. Well, and it also goes back to parents. If there is to be some agreement around a number of professional networks, there probably needs to be a statement. Something that says,
yep,
this is what we believe, essentially. I'm not thinking it's a manifesto, but it's just saying, you know, February was one hell of a hot month, and it's just going to get worse, quite likely. What are
how
we
well,
all doing?
And the kinds of and the ways in which the existing paradigm needs to change if progress is going to be made. That's what the Forest Service folks are trying to do, is figure out what the new paradigm is and where things need to be headed.
Right. And where they need to be headed is also connected to what heads them in a new direction. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. What
okay, am I hearing two things?
Supports and drives the change.
I'm hearing bridging the silos in the new normal, and I'm hearing that we need to address that at different geographic scope levels.
Mm-hmm. It's those things, but there's something more. I'm not sure what that more is
yet. Okay.
It doesn't feel enough yet.
Okay.
We didn't intend for the global changes that we have, right?
Right.
We didn't intend for climate change.
Right.
Yeah, and I think this is a little bit of free associating, but I think it's worth is somebody talking to us that I can't quite hear?
Oh, somebody's got a lot of background noise.
Yeah. That would be good.
Okay. I think one of the things that we miss a lot in talking about climate change is that climate change is the result of doing wonderful things, and fossil fuels are incredible for what they've done for the world. If you look around wherever you are right now, chances are that virtually everything you see is there because of fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And we ignore that all of the time in our discussions about how to change the world. And that's I think, a fundamental part of why people tend to block out climate change is because we're ignoring that we're paying attention to how awful fossil fuels are, which is true, but ignoring how wonderful fossil fuels are, which is also true.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, Don, there's another piece that came out of Bale Sinatra and Doug Lombardi's research on educational learning related to climate change. Was and this got me back to that deep ecology thought, was that one of the real mental barriers that people have is they just don't think it's plausible for climate change to be human caused. And if you don't think it's plausible, you can you can look at all the evidence you want, you can look at the graphs and say things skillfully back, but you don't really think it's possible. It's like, you know, today is the sky is falling. Well, no, it's not. I mean, I can say you said it's falling, but I don't actually really believe it. And so there's a mental thing we're messing with pretty heavily with people, and, and they have to wrestle with it to the point that there are Christians who say it's not possible because only God changes the earth. Man can't do it. It's their interpretation of the way they read the Bible says that can't be true. And, you know, it's that kind of stuff that just, there's a whole set of them that get in the way of that, plus what you said, plus probably some more. And if we're going to wrestle with that with people, it's going to take time. Skilled professionals with lots of time in order to successfully navigate a lot of the social, cultural issues and cognitive issues and knowledge gap issues and value issues simultaneously. I mean, that's a monstrous challenge. And yet it's what's before us.
Right. Piece of cake.
All right, you got that? Did you write the treatise?
It is the word.
Maybe we should think of it as a treatise, right? As our I don't know. I mean, it feels big, right?
See, now, this is Scott. I kind of go the other way. And that is that I ultimately think that writing about this, in many ways, the ideas we're talking about are definitely not new. They've certainly been in the ecology literature for a long, long time, the deep ecology, other folks, too. And you can go much, much back further, too. I'm actually coming to be convinced that the only way to deal with this is locally and in your own community, doing that stuff so that it just simply becomes a case study for others to replicate. And I come at that, and I can, you know, I'll go big too, because I also know that's actually how complex systems evolve. Small changes happen someplace. We can talk about mitigation in, you know, supersaturated solutions. I'm a chemist. And what happens is something, you know, interesting happens in one place, and it gets replicated throughout the entire system. That's how change happens. And so I'm kind of going the other way, and I think that what we do is in our own communities, we do the best damn projects we can, whatever form that takes, whether it's, you know, land use planning, whether it's transportation, you know, bike share programs, whatever it is, and that when we talk about what we're doing, we put it in the larger context. We're doing this because of these kind of consequences. And I can talk about an example that I was involved in here in Seattle. We put together, I used to work with the Sierra Club in transportation, and we put together a number of principles. And one of those principles was that you can't build more lanes for cars and at the same time reduce the amount of CO2 that you're producing. So building new roadways is not the way to go. And we use that principle basically as a way of making choices or helping to make choices in terms of transportation options. That had an enormous consequence. We were able to fight and win a ballot measure, which I think it was $2 or $3 billion worth of transportation kinds of investments. That has had an enormous impact on this region. We don't talk in this region about building roadways anymore. We talk about extending light rail. So I guess that's from my from my perspective, it's making those what appear to be local choices and putting them in the context of the bigger issues at play here. And I'm convinced now that that's really the only way it works. Mm-hmm. Other people will pick up what you're doing locally, and it will be replicated around the country and the world.
Here, Scott. This is Kristen.
Minnesota.
Yay. Actually, I have two things I've been wanting to squeeze in here. One of them is just to add to that. I had a sort of bipolar day yesterday with the big article coming out about February warming was just like in my feed of news everywhere and sort of a downer in my day. But we also had 100 youth meet with our governor and two commissioners at the Capitol yesterday for an hour-long meeting. And, their first question to him is about the Clean Power Plan and are we going to keep implementing it? And he says yes. And so having that voice out there is really powerful. And it's at a local level, like building momentum at a local level. The other thing, though, as we're talking about as a network to do sort of thing, I was at University of Minnesota does an evaluation spring institute every year, and I went to a really interesting session on how people are starting to think about measuring collective impact, which is something as a network, obviously, we've been looking at. Yep. And I thought the speaker she did a really great job. She was from University of Wisconsin, and I actually spoke with her afterwards and asked her if she'd be ever interested in speaking on one of our calls. But that, I think, is an opportunity for us to showcase what you're saying, Scott, the local work that's happening, but how can we actually measure that sort of impact? Mm-hmm. What is one thing we could do? As a community to show that piece. So that, I think, and I'm always looking at things through an evaluation lens. That's my interest, but I think that is that's where the case studies of the work we do and the actual argument that we are doing good work, if we start looking at it on a local level, piece comes in.
And it's the replication of that local work elsewhere and adaptation and modification of it in other venues. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But there's one other piece, though, that... Sorry. Go ahead. I've spoken a lot.
This is Lynn Sherry, and I just wanted to agree with Scott and Kristen. And here in Massachusetts, we're trying to get this carbon fee and dividend a Massachusetts bill, and I think that serves the same purpose. If we can get this pay and dividend passed in Massachusetts, then it sets a precedent for the rest of the country. So
absolutely.
Just agreeing with you.
Yep.
I guess the part that always concerns me, I think it's the only way it ever does work, but at some level, it's got to add up. I mean, now since we're thinking on a planetary level, not just the U.S. level and not just the state level, it's got to add up. And so there's got to be something that is a target that each of us have to figure out what works for us, but it's got to be related to a target, something that is driving us towards something intentionally that, is everybody's got to pull their own weight. How they pull it, that's locally determined.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's like as a network, I think part of this session we are talking about too with collective impact was what's the simple rules of this network, which in some ways are what are our major outcomes that we are all aligned to that we could look at and say in each individual place, how does this add up to this piece that we have as an agreed upon, goal? And then you learn through that process, too. But by looking at what we do, then we can figure out how you add it up or if there's a different way to add it up.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's like two things, which is probably what you'd be able to come to. But
it'd be interesting to see what those commonalities are.
What those what?
commonality, what
yeah.
we share in common, and how they add up.
Yeah, there is, you know, I went to this other session on ripple effect mapping, which mm-hmm. I would love to see done. It's he has a two-hour sort of process he does where he builds out basically a big concept map and based on people's answers to sort of different questions about, you know, the impact they're having. And then you can take that and very easily turn it into a logic model. I mean, through this mm-hmm. through this process. And it was just really interesting to see. But those sort of themes come out then when you ask these, you know, questions. You're asking, you know, what's the work you do, or what's your anticipated, your measurable outcome of the work that you do? What's the big goal you have? Mm-hmm. Like our organization, I think our big goal now is 100% renewables by 2050. That's like our big goal. So all the work mm-hmm. we do drives towards that in some direction, whether it be education or youth organizing, or is that, you know, what is the Climate Literacy Network? What is our big goal that we all work towards, but in different ways, and how, where are the overlaps towards that goal?
Mm-hmm.
Can you send out some info on that ripple effect mapping? That sounds interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It was so tangible. It was one of those things I went away
yeah.
with. I was like, this is so cool. I just want to do
yeah.
this like
yeah.
right now.
Hey, Kristen, can you give us a connection to some ripple effect resource?
Yeah, I have the handout and slides from the from the session, so I'll send it out.
Great.
And thank you.
If you could put on the subject the line ripple effect or something, that'd help.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
Great. Great. Well, and that sets up a whole series of questions for itself. I mean, Kristen, you said it very nicely. Is, you know, what are those kinds of goals that we have as a network? And you know, we're talking. It's sort of, and I think Karen's alluded to this too, is that notion of there's multiple levels here and they have different kinds of impacts on it. You certainly see that in forest management. And what are the, we haven't really articulated what we see as those levels. And part of the problem, I think, on the network is we have these calls at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning. We don't have anybody we have very few teachers that are actually implementing the kinds of educational resources that we talk about all the time. So we're kind of missing that lower level. Like, is this, you know, are these, you know, do we know whether the resources that we propose in the clean collection, do we have even a sense in which those really are working, that, in fact, the criterion that we've used to evaluate those really are, you know, working classroom type of criteria? And then the other side, of course, is the higher policy stuff. Are there things that we don't really talk about? We have today. But what are the higher level policy things? What are the messages that we would like to take to Congress or the administration and say, here are the barriers that we're seeing in the work that we're doing. Let's talk about it. Can we change that in some way in which we all can be collectively more effective?
Hey, Scott, I think one maybe way to, and I'm going to have to scoot off after this comment, is think about the process it would be to get to the end of this that is inclusive, that is strategic, that is, you know, enduring, and has lots of network representation and practitioners all at the same mm-hmm. time. It feels like, you know, when we made the Climate Literacy Guide, there was a lot of process.
Mm-hmm.
by the way we came to that. And I think what we're talking about is worthy, if not even more worthy than that document or similar documents. So I think that this is bigger than, you know, a series of phone calls.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and clearly I'm going to have to go because the president's leaving. and that's what all that sound is. That's not spring peepers, guys. All right, guys. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks, Frank.
Thanks, Frank.
Well, it sounds like we're kind of developing some kind of work plan here, which is something that we really haven't collectively talked about. But we seem to be saying there's something that we need to be writing down and thinking through more carefully than we do is a sequence of calls and discussions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Never know quite how to do that.
Yeah.
Since we're all doing our own little projects, our focused projects. So any other comments?
Do you feel better, Don, or feel worse?
I do feel better. Thank you for the nice therapy session.
It was a good phone call then.
If nothing else, clean is therapy.
Can I just make a request?
Please do.
Is everyone leaving already? Everyone's leaving.
Now we're still here. I think people are still here. Go ahead. There's some continuing background noise, but I think people are still here.
Yeah. I think we can't get their attention. Oh, good.
Is that Lynn that wants to speak?
Yeah, it sounds like. Did we lose Lynn?
Did we lose Lynn?
Lynn, you're muted.
Maybe we
did. Well, I guess we have lost Lynn then. We'll have to save that until another time.
Yeah.
So any other last comments? We're getting close to the top of the hour.
Yeah. So
please,
well, thanks for the therapy.
Okay. Anytime.
This is Jen from the Wild Center. I've been just listening.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, everybody. So I actually, one of the things that I recently had a chance to participate in with our youth climate program, we attended a session that it was at a local college that was hosting a basically a climate engagement session for this program called Climate Ambassadors, which is actually through the Vatican. So it's people that are in the U.S. There's a group of them. I think there's like maybe 20 across the U.S. that have been appointed by the Pope to be climate ambassadors. And they were learning about effective climate communication and how to create good presentations and sort of thinking about their messaging and speaking points. And I attended with a group of about 8 high school students that are some of our youth climate leaders. And it was just, for me, like this really interesting, thinking about like coming at climate change from our moral, as a moral obligation, as we all know with the Pope's encyclical, but it was also like sort of a collision of worlds as I'm coming from the Science Center perspective and then like hearing, you know, where not just the Catholic Church, but kind of looking at faith communities across the spectrum. And I guess this is more of, I'm just like throwing this into the mix of kind of where, you know, the students that attended were like so, they had always come at it from this kind of more of a science perspective, but they also are very strongly feel like it's our moral obligation, like as a generation to fix this because of all of the social issues. And I just sometimes I really struggle with where that fits with all the science that we come at it from. Like I feel like I'm primarily coming at it from the science end, and this moral piece is even though I feel it personally, it's hard to figure out where institutionally or even as a giant network, like where that fits into the scope. Because lots of organizations are working at it from a social or environmental justice perspective. Anyway, I just wanted to share that because. I feel the need for therapy, and I think that sort of thinking about kind of this big picture stuff, you know, there's all these different entry points to be thinking about how we move forward collectively, and, you know, I love the idea of kind of this kind of group process or group think around what are those big goals that we're shooting for, or like Kristen said, like, I can't remember exactly the number, but like I think it was 2050. Kristen, are you still on the line? She may have gotten off. But anyway, like thinking about renewables in Minnesota and like being 100% renewable by 2050 or whatever those targets are. But like what does it actually take to get to that point in a state or in our country or planetarily anyway? And breaking down the silos. And I'm not even sure if I know where all the silos are yet. So that was the other thought I had is, like, I know we need to break down silos and work across all these different sectors, but I'm not even sure what silos are preventing us from all working together.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it.
Yeah. Good.
Well, maybe the bigger goal up above being 100% renewable by 2050 is about trying to keep to that 1.5 degrees.
Yeah.
So maybe the goals are different at different levels of governance.
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking at the global piece, it has its goals, but each country has their goals underneath that. So maybe we need to clarify the U.S. goals, and then I'm with you guys. It's like breaking it down to a chunk that your mind can deal with.
Right. But always keeping the context of the broader context here, which is on a planetary level. Yeah.
Which is planet Earth.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's right.
We're all Earthlings.
Spaceship Earth.
Only Earthlings are allowed on this phone call, right?
Yeah, pretty bad, as far as we know. Well, I have about 1 minute to the top of the hour. Are there any last thoughts?
Yeah. I've got one, and I don't know if anyone read the Time magazine on how the new approach they're taking on Alzheimer's. So this is a systems idea. Mm-hmm. And instead of looking at just trying to get rid of the bad stuff, the amyloid and the tau proteins, they're looking at, because here's what they've seen. People who do have Alzheimer's, all of their brains have those bad things in them. But what they also know is there are healthy people that have those things in them as well. Mm-hmm. So the new approach is to be looking at what makes those people resilient to the attack by the bad stuff. So what I think that has to do with us is how you approach climate change stuff. And you don't just look at the bad stuff, you look at how do we create healthy systems on planet Earth.
And it's, you know, in a very direct way is, you know, we push on, oh, we need to reduce the amount of CO2. And we don't turn that around and says, but in the process of doing that, cleaning up the coal-fired power plants, whatever, reducing the amount of particulates, and health. We have health in that. And that becomes the positive way and says, we don't want to go that way. And, so the focus is really on the health impacts rather than on some sort of obscure notion of how many parts per million, of CO2 we have in the atmosphere. So, yeah, I think it's a great way to look at that, in whether it's Alzheimer's or what we're talking about. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, good. Let's look for those green handprints.
Exactly. Very good. Well, thanks, everyone. And we have a call coming up next week with Gail Francis and Jenny, I think Curtis is her last name, on work that's happening in the Midwest. And so it will be much more solutions-oriented, and I think it should be a very interesting talk. So thank you, everyone, today. Very interesting discussion. And talk with you guys.
Thank you, Scott.
Very good. Great. Bye now.
Thanks, all.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.